This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Wall Street Journal recently said, to understand what Republicans are trying to do about welfare, don't look to Newt Gingrich, watch Robert Rector. He's one of the gurus behind the GOP's rightward swerve on welfare reform. We invited Robert Rector to talk with us about welfare reform. Rector is a senior policy analyst on welfare and family issues at the think tank The Heritage Foundation. Yesterday, the Congress took a big step toward overhauling the welfare system. A congressional subcommittee approved a Republican bill that would turn over most of the welfare programs to the states. It would put a 5-year lifetime limit on the amount of time any person can receive welfare benefits and end benefits for unwed mothers under 18. I spoke with Robert Rector earlier today, and he told me he thinks the bill doesn't go far enough. I asked him what his role has been in shaping today's debate.
I've worked very hard for many years to focus on what I believe is the number one problem facing our nation and our welfare system, which is the collapse of the family. You know, when the war on poverty began in 1965, about 5% of American children are born out of wedlock. Today, that number is close to 33%. Clearly, the welfare system is not the only instrument in society responsible for that, but it is playing a large role. And what we have to do, we really have to face two questions as a nation. Bill Clinton himself has told us that illegitimacy, the breakdown of the family, is a key cause of crime. He has said that welfare plays a major role in promoting illegitimacy. And he warned us in the State of the Union last year that unless something dramatic is done, half of all American children are soon going to be born out of wedlock. So the first question that we face as a nation is, can we accept as a nation an impending 50% out of wedlock birth rate? And apparently, if we listen to everyone from Newt Gingrich to Eleanor Holmes Norton, the representative from the District of Columbia, no, we cannot. Then that's the easy question. Then comes the hard question, which is, all right, if we recognize that we can't accept a 50% out of wedlock birth rate or even a 33% one, which is where we are today, what do we propose to do about it? And to the extent that I've had a role in the welfare reform debate, it's been focusing on that question.
Do you think that welfare is an incentive for teenagers to have babies out of wedlock?
I don't think it works in that way. I don't think that there are very many young women in the United States who sit down and say, I'm going to have a baby so I can make a windfall killing out of welfare. What I do think it does, and it's not unique in this country, welfare enables young women to have children without the benefit of marriage, without being overly concerned about whether their sexual partner is going to be a stable father, is going to be committed and loyal to them. It breaks down the underlying norms in a social order, and it makes, as it has in many communities in the United States, both white and black, it makes having a child out of wedlock and rearing that child in a single-parent family a social norm that replaces marriage. That's what's happened in this country, and it's a tragedy for our nation. It's a tragedy for those young women. It's a tragedy for the fathers who never really get to become real fathers in other than a biological sense. It's a tragedy for those young women, and especially for the children, who are multiply disadvantaged in almost every conceivable respect by being raised in this new experimental family we have now, which is a mother at home alone married to a welfare check.
The bill that passed in the subcommittee yesterday would end benefits to single mothers 18 and under.
What the bill does is it says that starting 1 year after enactment, a young woman who has a child out of wedlock prospectively who is under 18 will not get federal cash welfare benefits. Any state that feels in its heart of heart that the best thing it can do is continue the present system to send that 16-year-old a check in the mail on the condition that she's had a child out of wedlock is perfectly free to do that. But I do think that the states, once they begin to use their own money for this very, very dubious activity, will begin to think much more aggressively and thoughtfully about alternatives that will care for children but will not have the inducement effect of creating more out-of-wedlock births in the future.
What do you think are the underlying reasons behind out-of-wedlock births? And maybe you could focus on teenagers who have babies out of wedlock.
I think there are two clear factors. One factor is the welfare system. The welfare system basically says, as it does in most nations, that if you are not married to an employed male, we will send you a check in the mail. We will give you a combined welfare benefits package that's worth about $14,000 a year when you add all the benefits together. However, if you get married, you will lose almost all of that assistance. That is a very strong factor. And the fact of the matter is that when we started piling one welfare benefit on top of another at the beginning of the war on poverty, we saw a huge spike up in the out-of-wedlock birth rate almost immediately. And it's continued at a very high level ever since then. Welfare is one big factor in the out-of-wedlock birth rate. The second big factor is the change in the culture, change in sexual mores, change in values, change in the way our society regarded marriage and single parenthood. I think that we're just at the very tiny edge of a beginning of a turnaround in those cultural norms and values. But I think in order to get a grip on illegitimacy and begin to reduce it, we both have to have welfare reform and some rather profound cultural changes, which I can go into later. And even then, we may not be able to save ourselves. But those are the minimum steps that we need.
I think nearly everybody agrees that things need to be changed within the welfare system. And the question becomes, what needs to be changed and how should it be changed? And I think a fundamental difference between groups on opposite extremes is that what one group is saying, the system needs to be changed, so let's cut people off, let's limit the number of years they're allowed to get welfare in a lifetime. And the other group is saying, well, let's change the rules so that the rules don't encourage bad behavior. The rules don't encourage couples to not get married.
You can't do that. I mean, that's a pipe dream, and the nation simply can't afford that.
There's no choice, you think, except to just cut people off.
Again, you just can't make the welfare system more liberal. One of the responses to this is to say, well, since the current welfare system subsidizes single parenthood and it makes it difficult for two-parent families to get on if the father's working, why don't we just open the system up and let all the two-parent families get on, even if the father is working? That would end up costing something like $1 or 2 trillion. We cannot afford that as a nation. The fact of the matter is that you cannot simply give everyone in society the amount of money which is currently being given to single mothers on AFDC, which is around $14,000 to $15,000 when you add all the benefits together. You have to begin to scale those benefits back. On the other hand, you can take certain small discrete steps of rewarding marriage, as we do in the Talent Faircloth bill, with a new refundable tax credit that's available solely to low-income parents who get married. But you can't simply say, the solution to welfare is to make this system more generous and allow everybody to get onto it. We can't afford that as a nation.
So the solution, though, that you're recommending is that teenagers who have children out of wedlock, they're just cut off. I mean, you think that that's the lesser of all the evils, just cutting them off.
In many respects, this is sort of like we're on the Titanic and we're proposing that we ought to get in lifeboats as the ship begins to go down, and people are saying, well, you know, it's very cold out there in those lifeboats. This society really cannot tolerate an further increase in its out-of-wedlock birth rate. However, we I'm not proposing simply to go cold turkey. What I would say is that starting 1 year after enactment of real reform legislation, any woman under age, say 21, who has a child out of wedlock would no longer receive direct welfare assistance from the federal government. But rather than just cutting her off, we should take those funds and make them available for alternative forms of care for the children. Those would include adoption or setting up maternity homes where the mother would reside with the child in a closely supervised group setting where she would have no walking around money for cigarettes, drugs, and alcohol, where she'd be required to finish high school, take parenting classes, and so forth. It would be a better environment for the child, but it would be a less attractive environment for the mother. What we want to have is to reform the welfare system with two goals in mind. One is to, as much as we can, reduce any conceivable enticement or for having children out of wedlock, or even an enabling mechanism for having children out of wedlock.
Let me stop you here. I didn't hear you mention orphanages. Are you opposed to orphanages?
Orphanages would be a last resort if the mother, I think, proves herself to be incompetent as a parent. I don't imagine any governor would be putting children in orphanages if the mother wants to stay with the child and is a good parent.
Robert Rector is my guest. He's a policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He's been credited with helping to shape the Republican welfare reform bill. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Rector is my guest, policy analyst for welfare and family issues with the Heritage Foundation. What are some of the other reasons you think that young women, teenagers, are having babies out of wedlock?
I think the main reason why young women or older women, 20, 21-year-old women, are having children out of wedlock is that women like babies, and they want to raise children. And what we used to have is a system where, in order to raise a child, there was a clear recognition that you needed to get married, you needed to find the right guy who wasn't necessarily the guy with the biggest biceps and the coolest guy on the street corner, but was rather a man who might be willing to stick with you for 35 years and bring in the support that was needed so that the two of you could support that family. That was the understanding which both young white and black women in the United States approached child rearing up through the 1960s and early 1970s. What welfare has done is tragically, and I think deceptively, created the impression in the minds of young women that they now can go ahead and have a family without being concerned about marriage, because welfare is going to step in there and support them. In fact, indeed, if they do get married, they will sort of suffer a net reduction in income. Therefore, they don't look at marriage as part of their life options and their life plans to any considerable degree.
What about some of the other reasons that other people have cited that they think help explain why teenagers are having babies? Reasons like low self-esteem, no hope of work, no ability to see beyond the life of poverty around them, poor education, peer pressure to have sex, boys' unwillingness to use condoms, girls being unwilling or unable to get to doctors for birth control. Do you think that those things come into play at all?
I think that those are largely superficial in all respects. The situation with that was much worse 30 years ago. If you looked at any of those things in terms of hope, optimism about the future, self-esteem, and so forth, the situation presumably would have been worse, particularly among blacks back in the 1950s. But blacks in the 1950s had a very high marriage rate. I really don't think that those are the major contributing factors in terms of shifting this behavior. I think it's rather a change in underlying values and a change in the welfare system. And those are the two issues that we need to tackle.
The way inflation and recession is regulated in the United States, it virtually assures a certain amount of unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to the chronically unemployed if welfare benefits end after 5 years? Now, I know you've said the states can always step in, but the states, on the whole, don't really have that kind of money. And if the federal government is absolving itself of responsibility and is setting a tone that says, hey, after 5 years, it's your problem, then why shouldn't the states just follow suit? I mean, what happens to these people?
I find it very ironical that for many, many years, the liberal establishment has told us that AFDC is a program of short-term dependence. And now, all of a sudden, we find out that, gosh, if we put a five-year time limit on this thing, that about half the caseload is going to go over that time limit 5 years from now.
Well, let me just clarify something. I think the criticism is that it's short-term dependence for the people who say that, but over a period of time. So in a lifetime, there might be 7 years worth of intervals.
It is primarily long-term dependence, although it can be somewhat intermittent. Those individuals are simply mischaracterizing the program. But the bottom line is that we can, in fact, run some programs that will effectively reduce the caseload. If you look at the state of Wisconsin, Wisconsin says that taking a woman that doesn't have a child under age three, the minute that woman comes on to AFDC, they put her into a motivation program, require her to look for work, and in fact, in the counties most throughout most of Wisconsin where they've done that, they've achieved a 40% to 50% reduction in caseload. That frees up a lot of money to deal with the residual population of long-term people that really can't be self-sufficient. Although in the counties that I've been to in Wisconsin, there weren't that many people like that on the rolls. So I think that we do have more options here than most people recognize, and that it is easier in many respects to move part of the AFDC caseload off than we may have appreciated in the past.
What are some of the things that you've observed in your life, or what have some of your personal encounters with poverty been that have helped shape your views?
I have spent time as a younger person working both in what were essentially Head Start programs, as well as being involved in charity at my church level. And I learned very early on that you have to be very careful in giving charity, lest you foster a climate of dependence. My favorite welfare reform expert happens to be the Apostle Paul, who in setting out the guidelines for the early Christian church for charity in the New Testament said that he who shall not work shall not eat. I often ask the question, well, why did Paul say that? Had he been listening to Rush Limbaugh, or maybe he had a Roper poll that indicated that that would be popular with the congregations and the churches? I don't think that was the reason, and I don't think that was the reason why all U.S. charity was guided by that maxim right up through the late 1920s. It was rather a recognition that charity which is given unconditionally, which is what we started doing in the war on poverty, that you simply give to someone who is in apparent need of aid, has two effects. One, it creates an almost inexhaustible demand for the charity. The more you give in that manner, the more people who will line up for receipt of that aid. They knew that way back in the 1880s. The second is that charity that is given in that manner without requiring responsible behavior or contribution back from the person that's given the aid has a destructive effect on the very spirit of the person that you're trying to aid, and that you're actually harming rather than helping that person.
You had said that women become single mothers because women want to have babies, and now they're just doing it at a younger age, and they're doing it out of wedlock. Do you support programs for sexual education on mm-hmm. contraception, issues like that? And a related question, what happens to a woman if a man leaves her? I mean, what... Mm-hmm. Say she expected he really was going to marry her, then what?
I think it's very clear that programs that simply provide sort of biological instruction plus knowledge of contraceptives have no effect whatsoever. I think both sides of the political spectrum agree on that. We also know that programs that couple that with a moral message saying abstain from sexual activity, that you can control your own behavior and it's best in your best interest, also do at least have a short-term, rather significant effect in reducing sexual activity. I would go one step farther, and I would like to experiment with programs where we took young women who are very much at risk of having a child out of wedlock, and we can identify those individuals as social scientists well in advance. And I'd like to experiment scientifically with programs where you, say, took a young girl like that at age 16, gave her a firm abstinence curriculum, and said to her, if you avoid an out-of-wedlock pregnancy for the next 4 years, we'll give you $1,000 a year. We'll put the money 1 year at a time into an escrow account. You get through 4 years, you'll have $4,000 in that account. I don't really know what that type of program would do, but I think that that's exactly the kind of thing that we ought to experiment with. Instead of rewarding people for destroying their own lives and behaving irresponsibly, we ought to reward and encourage them for keeping their own lives on track.
What if? What are your suggestions if a young woman gets pregnant, she thought in her heart of hearts she would marry this man?
Mm-hmm.
And he either leaves or just decides he doesn't want to get married. Should she be without benefits because of that?
Is she
being punished?
We're not talking about cutting her off from benefits. What we're saying
I'm referring to the federal policy.
Well, even the federal policy makes funds available for maternity homes, for adoption, and other things like that. We're not talking about simply putting people on the street.
Say she wants to keep her baby and she doesn't want to live in a maternity home.
Well, then now she's made a series of choices. She has decided to become sexually active. She didn't get married. She has decided not to put the child up for adoption. And now she decides that she doesn't want to receive a care in a maternity home, and she can't support this child by herself. Does the society have an obligation to provide her with a check in the mail? No. And I think that by this time you're talking about a person that probably isn't a particularly responsible parent. I would give her the option of coming into a maternity home, but I'm not going to send her a check in the mail.
Is there anything you think people on both sides of the welfare debate have in common?
I believe I would give President Clinton a great deal of credit for having been the first president to firmly speak out and identify illegitimacy as our number one social problem. President Clinton has told us that illegitimacy is the cause of crime, that welfare causes illegitimacy, and that we've got to do something dramatic about it. I give him a great deal of credit, and I think that is an indication of a growing, at least an intellectual consensus on what the problem is. It's much more difficult when you get down to the talking about how you solve it, but I'm very gratified that we, at least as a nation, are beginning to talk about this problem.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Rector is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.